I'm really pleased to welcome you to our panel on Beyond Iraq. My name is Joe Becker, and I'm one of this year's Aspen Ideas Festival Fellows. And it's really a privilege for me to have 2 minutes at the beginning of this session to present my big idea. I work for Human Rights Watch, an organization that documents human rights abuses in about 70 countries around the world. Increasingly, we're documenting human rights abuses related to war. One of the most heartbreaking things that we see is the recruitment of children as young as 12, 13, 14 years old to fight in today's wars. My big idea is related to ending the use of child soldiers. A few years ago, I was doing research in Burma, and I met a young boy named Ong. Ong was recruited when he was 11 years old and forced into the government army and told if he refused, he would go to jail. He went into combat the first time when he was only 12 years old. When he was 13, he saw his unit commit a massacre of unarmed women and children. He told me when he was 14, he couldn't take it anymore, and he risked his life and ran away. There are too many children like Ong. But we have made some progress on this issue. Just 8 years ago, it was still legal under international law to send 15-year-olds into war. Today, there are 120 countries, including the United States, that have ratified a new UN treaty saying that they will not deploy their soldiers till at least age 18. Most of today's child soldiers, and there are tens of thousands of them, serve in rebel armies. But there are also many who serve in the armies of governments and government-linked paramilitaries. Today, there are 9 governments that are implicated in this phenomenon, and 8 of them receive some form of U.S. military assistance. The big idea, and I confess it wasn't mine alone, I worked with a couple of NGO colleagues, was to try and change the behavior of these governments by restricting their access to U.S. military assistance until they end their use of child soldiers. We took our idea to Senator Durbin of Illinois, and he took it to Senator Brownback of Kansas. Together, they introduced a bill into the Senate. 35 other senators, both Republican and Democrat, liked the idea and have co-sponsored this bill. It's called the Child Soldiers Prevention Act. We're not quite there. We could use your support for the idea by asking your senators to support the Child Soldiers Prevention Act. But if this becomes law, I'm convinced it will change the lives of thousands of children. Thank you. I'm now really pleased to introduce the moderator of today's event. Kurt Campbell is the CEO and the co-founder of the Center for a New American Security. He's also the director of the Aspen Security Group at the Aspen Institute. Please welcome Kurt Campbell.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks. Welcome to everyone. It's terrific to see such a wonderful turnout to what I know will be an excellent panel. I'm fortunate enough to run the Aspen Strategy Group, which is part of the Aspen Institute. Every summer, we try to take Democrats in Washington out of hot, humid weather, bring them to Aspen, and force them to get along over the course of a week and confront hard issues associated with national security. Talked to Walter and to Elliot, and I said, really, Aspen Ideas, such a fantastic venue. We really need to do a little bit more in terms of looking at the foreign policy and national security challenges confronting the United States and the world, and they've done a wonderful job this year, and this turnout really is a tribute to your interest in these issues. We're really going to tackle today issues confronting the next administration, not just the inheritance associated with Iraq, but what else beyond Iraq. And for that, I think we have just a terrific panel before you. And I want to say we do want to open this up to questions after we get some early discussion going. I'd ask you, I'd really urge you, if at all possible, restrain from long personal views. If you have a question, I mean, that's really what families are for, to talk to them privately. If you have a question, we'd really want to take, and we want to get through as many people as possible. I'm going to quickly introduce folks from right to left, and then I'm going to actually ask Jim Steinberg to start and Admiral Ruffhead to go second. To my immediate right is Robert Kaplan. He is familiar to many of you, senior writer with the Atlantic Monthly, a very well-published author. I'm also grateful he's a fellow at my center, the Center for a New American Security. His books span the gamut. He is actually currently working on a fascinating book. I think many of you know that the debate about which is the major ocean of the future, is it the Atlantic or is it the Pacific? He's writing a book on the Indian Ocean, suggesting that competition for resources and power and prestige between India and China will be defining for the world in the 21st century, and we really welcome him. This is his first time to the Aspen Ideas Festival. To his right, I want you all to recognize how hard it is for a person like Admiral Roughhead to get out of Washington to join us here today. And it's just it's a tribute to him that he understands the importance of getting out and doing public diplomacy. He has an incredibly distinguished career. For me, I was in the Navy. My goal was someday to be the CNO, and I almost made it. I was a lieutenant, so only about a thousand things. But Admiral Ruffert has served with great distinction, major commands in both the Atlantic and Pacific. He's charged now with training and equipping and preparing our forces. I would say to you that one of the most important foreign policy successes of this administration is our response to the tsunami in Indonesia and also other parts of the Southern Pacific. Tragedy, and the person who is responsible for organizing the massive, the largest humanitarian relief effort in our history, in global history, is Admiral Roughhead. And we're really grateful for him. That personal tribute to him, and we really appreciate him taking his time to join us here today. To his right is James Steinberg, the Dean of the LBJ School of Government at the University of Texas in Austin. Jim has served in great distinction in a number of capacities. He was the vice president at Brookings, head of their foreign policy program for several years. Before that, he was the deputy national security advisor to the president, probably the hardest job in the U.S. government. Jim conducted it flawlessly. He also served as the head of policy planning, the great, wonderful George Kennan job in the U.S. government. He has published widely. He's very well regarded. You may have seen a couple of weeks ago in the very small group of senior people that had been rolled out as being the senior advisors to Senator Obama, Jim Steinberg was basically first among them. So we're very grateful that Jim could join us today. To his right is Bob Kagan. Bob Kagan is currently currently a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He spent the last couple of years doing battle intellectually with Europeans living overseas while his wife has ably served at NATO headquarters. He is the author of some of the most thought-provoking and incredibly important books. Most recently, his book on the return of history and the end of dreams has just been published. I urge all of you to go out and get a copy of this. It's a fantastic primer about how to think about the future. He is a great public intellectual, easily one of the most influential thinkers in American foreign policy, national security. This, too, is his first visit to the Aspen Ideas Festival. He's a terrific guy, and we're very grateful that he's joining us as well. So the way we're going to do this is we're just going to open it up. Jim, let's say a president gets elected. That's going to happen. You're advising that president. How do you help him think about the challenges confronting the United States? What's your hierarchy? How do you conceptualize the U.S. government in terms of its responses to this very difficult set of challenges ahead?
Well, thanks for such a simple and straightforward question, Kurt, that I can answer with just yes and no.
Okay.
First of all, let me also join Kurt in saying how terrific it is to have so many people here, because these are important issues, and I think this is a really very consequential time that we're facing in the life of our country. This is an important election coming up in which national security issues are going to be very, very significant and very prominent. And I think it's obviously going to be a time in which there's a lot of debate about both how well we've been meeting the challenges in the past and what's the best way to go forward. I also want to just stress for prudence sake that I speak neither for the University of Texas nor any presidential campaign, but only for myself. But I do think that what is going to be critical about this next presidency is really to help the American people and the world understand what is the perspective of the United States, both in terms of what the challenges are going forward and what role the United States is going to play in the world. I don't need to tell this audience or any audience that for the past 7+ years, we've really been dominated by a view of the world that has emphasized and sort of structured our national security strategy around what the administration at least used to call the global war on terrorism, and defined this as kind of the signature challenge facing the United States, just as the Soviet Union and the challenge of communism was the signature and organizing challenge facing the United States during the Cold War. And I think now the next president is going to have to reflect on the question about whether that is the right paradigm, whether that really does represent the best way to structure our thinking about the problems facing the United States going forward, or whether we need a different framework which would then help organize and set forth the priorities. And in my own view, we do need another framework. Not that the problem of radical terrorists is not a serious threat to our security. There are lots of people out there who do mean us grave harm and would do whatever they can to damage our society and our way of life. But in my view, the problem with that formulation is that it has taken a tactic, a problem of tactics, and a problem of dealing with this very determined group of people, and in effect try to make all of our problems subordinate to that. And I think in the world we live today, the world is more complicated, and terrorism is one of the challenges that we face. But I think we face a more significant set of problems around two very broad developments in the international environment that ought to guide our strategy and guide our priorities. The first is globalization and interdependence. It's always been the case that no country, no matter how strong, can't solve any of the problems by itself. But I think there's been an illusion to some extent in recent years, because the United States is so powerful in our military, in our economic affairs, and the like, that when the push comes to shove, if we need to deal with a problem, we can handle it by ourselves. It would be great to have others working with us, but if we need to do it, we'll deal with it ourselves, and we need to focus on our ability to do that. As I say, I don't think there was ever the right answer to dealing with our national security problems. We've seen throughout our history the importance of friends and allies. But in this globalized and interdependent world, all of the big challenges that we face, including terrorism, require us to find new ways to cooperate with others. We can't deal with the terrorist problem unless we're getting support in countries like Pakistan, working with our European allies, working in the Gulf and the Middle East. And so whether it's terrorism or global climate change or dealing with the problem of proliferation, we have to find ways to recognize that we need the support of others. We need to find new strategies for collaborating with others, which means, one, we need to think about how we develop and modify the institutions we developed during the Cold War, ranging from our alliances like NATO to international institutions like the UN, to be effective in giving us the kind of collaboration we need. And second, we have to recognize that if we want others to work with us, we have to be responsive to their concerns as well. We can't just say it's our way or the highway. We have to be more willing to try to develop a definition of our national interest which recognizes the interests and concerns of others. So that, I think, is the first organizing principle that we need to bring to our national security strategy. And then I think the second thing that we really need to recognize is that as we go forward with these challenges, that there are a new set of problems that are coming up that are not the traditional national security challenges of the past. We still have to deal with important powers and strong nations, but we also have to deal with the kinds of threats and challenges that are not directly coming from rival powers. So we have to worry about issues like climate change. We have to worry about the possibility of pandemic disease. And we have to think about how we address problems in which we don't have a nation-state adversary, but we have either non-state actors like terrorists, or we have natural phenomena that are not only require collaboration, but require new ways to do business, to organize our government, and to think about strategies that can both deal with those threats and also make our own society more resilient so that these forces can't disrupt our way of life, can't undermine our security. And we have to do that in a world in which not only are these new actors, but also other countries are becoming important and more influential in their own right, particularly in the developing world, the so-called BRICS, Brazil, India, China, and these others, where we're seeing a power shift that means we have the potential of difficult and controversial relations with these countries, but also the potential of having them as partners to deal with these challenges. So if we take this new framework that recognizes that we are in a world of greater interdependence, that we may face threats from traditional nation-state threats, but also very untraditional threats, then we need to think about how do we become effective in this world. And I think, as I say, the keys to this are, one, for us to articulate a definition of our own national interest that recognizes a more inclusive sense that we are out there listening to others, taking into account their perspectives and building strategies that are more win-win and not win-lose strategies or us and them. And second, trying to strengthen our tools that allow us to cooperate with others, both in terms of our own capacity here at home, but also in terms of our friendships, our alliances, and the international institutions that can deal with these new challenges.
Thanks, Jim. One of the interesting things about a transition in our system of government, as opposed to a British or Westminster style, is that you have huge number of people turning over. It's not just a couple of people, but massive numbers of folks leave their jobs. And for the first time since 1952, a sitting vice president is not running for president. So you're going to have major new people coming in and leaving. And in our system of government, the one area of continuity, really, other than the civil service, is the military. And so, Admiral, the question I'd ask you, you're inevitably going to have a new group of civilians coming into the Pentagon and to the White House. If you were going to have to brief them about how to think about the world and the challenges confronting us, given your experience over the last several years, what would it be?
I think one of the things that I would do is look at not just where the challenges are, but where are the opportunities for the nation. And in the year leading up to last October, we in the Navy devoted a significant amount of attention, thought, and even travel as we went out around the country to talk to leaders in government, business, and academia to look into the future and where must we as a, and I'll speak for my service, the Navy, be. And we believe that the future areas of interest for us are the Western Pacific, Indian Ocean region, and the Arabian Gulf, because that is where our prosperity is derived and where the prosperity of our allies and friends and partners are derived. So the concentration there will be extremely important. And the need to not simply focus on the current operations that we have underway in the Middle East, in Iraq and Afghanistan, but to think about the trends that are occurring and to put in place what I call the best options. And that takes the form of what type of concepts do we have in place, what type of policies do we have in place, and what are the procurements that are being undertaken by the military to deliver for the administration and the future leaders of the nation decades in advance. What can we deliver in the form of best options for them? And that's a hard thing to do, I believe, in the circumstances that we find ourselves in. But we have to see how some of these trends are moving. In my realm, for example, there are many who think that the submarine is a relic of the Cold War. In the next two decades, the number of submarines in the world will increase by 50%. That gets to some fundamental issues that relate to the prosperity of our country. 90% of that which moves on the surface of the globe moves on the water. There is nothing more disruptive to that flow than a submarine, because you don't really know if it's there, and you begin to see phantoms everywhere. So how do we approach that? The proliferation of ballistic missiles. I believe that that will lead us toward a weapon of blackmail and intimidation. They're becoming more sophisticated. So what are the types of things that we must do relative to that? I also think that the area where many of our future battles will be fought, and indeed are being fought now, are in the area of cyberspace. How do we protect our networks? And then how do we put ourselves in a position to what I say allow us to gain decision advantage or decision superiority? Because in the future, speed will matter. And that speed will be driven by how we move information, how that information is protected, and then how that information is being acted upon. And the battle space of the future is going to change. Precision is going to be increasingly important as combatants mix with non-combatants and as battlefields move into urban areas in ways that we're seeing today. So how do you discriminate? How do you make that decision and take that speed of decision and apply it to the type of warfare that we may face? I would also say that the young men and women that will serve in the military have to have a very, very sophisticated view of the world in which they live. They will have to be culturally aware. They will also have to be comfortable with assimilating large amounts of information. When I came in the Navy, my battle space was defined by the range of the radar, which really was a function of the height of the mast, like being on top of a mountain, you see farther. Today, I can sit in any one of the ships in the United States Navy. If I'm in the Pacific, I can talk to somebody in the Atlantic, and I can see what they're looking at in the Atlantic. So how do you move that information? How do you make those types of decisions? I also believe that that future leaders must be very, very attuned to what I think will become hypersensitivity to issues of sovereignty, the ability for us to operate and not even be perceived to be infringing on other nations' sovereignty. And that's where I believe the Navy and the Marine Corps are able to provide that global presence in those areas that are of greatest interest to this nation, and that we can be there and not be there because we are not on someone's sovereign soil. The demographics of our own nation are going to be a challenge. How do we take the generation of young men and women who are serving and who will serve in the future and attract them into the military, retain them into the military, and recruit them in and then retain them? And what are the policies that really must address what is becoming the work-life balance, or the millennials may say the life-work balance? What must we be doing with regard to career options and opportunities for those young people? And an area that's of great interest to me and great focus for me is the issue of diversity within our military. The military of the United States must reflect the nation. Our total force does. Our leadership does not. It is largely white male. That is not what our demographic will be in 2050. And we have to work today to put in place that demographic of 40 years from now. There are also internal challenges that must be addressed. The methods that we have and the policies that we have with regard to procuring the systems that our men and women will use in the military is one that has become very cumbersome, very expensive, and very unresponsive to the demands of tomorrow. So that's an area that I believe we must pay particular attention to. So with that, I'll end there, Kurt. Thank you.
Thanks, Admiral. It's a very polite crowd. That's great. To Bob Kagan. Bob, maybe particularly from your perspectives that you've had from living abroad in Europe, help us think a little bit about both the inheritance in the Middle East, Iraq, Afghanistan, other issues associated with Iran. How much time are they going to require? What do you think the debates will be like swirling in both Republican and Democratic circles in terms of next steps?
Oh, I thought this was the Beyond Iraq panel.
Beyond and
okay. This isn't the Beyond Iraq panel.
Right.
Okay. Well, first of all, if you don't mind, let me just say that I actually would want to agree with two things that Jim says, which is A, that the United States really does need to work very hard. The next president needs to work very hard at making the United States into an international good citizen again, and that there's no question that the image of the United States is damaged and needs to be repaired. And I think whoever's in the White House is going to have to do that. When you get, and that does mean addressing the interests not only of the United States but also of other countries. And we took, I think, a far too narrow definition of interests pretty much when the Bush administration took power, but certainly after September 11th, and I would also agree with Jim that we need to get beyond the war on terror paradigm, which leads me into your point. If you think about, living in Europe, I would say the hostility to the American intervention is great. The salience of the issue is not as much as it once was, as a kind of lightning rod. And I don't think, actually, that anyone in Europe will be grateful to the United States for pulling out of Iraq too quickly and irresponsibly, that the area is too important to them. Stability in the region is extremely important to them. And that whatever their unhappiness with the American intervention, they don't want the United States to compound the error in their ideas by pulling out too quickly and leaving a disaster behind. And I think it's interesting to see, you know, the French foreign minister making, I think, now two trips to Iraq over the last year and emphasizing the that there is progress. And, you know, I think people see business interests there as well, obviously. We always knew that this war was fought for French oil interests. But I think that, you know, in that is this desire to see responsible behavior on our part. But I would say, while we are going to be having to deal with Iraq and Afghanistan, and while we're obviously going to have to focus, any president is going to spend his first weeks in office being briefed up on how to deal with the threat of terrorism. There's just no issue that could possibly surpass that. But when we get to the next phase of thinking about things, I think we need to look at a world in which we are dealing with a return of geopolitical competition. And that's the only element. I mean, what I have to say that is additive to Jim's, not subtracting. I'm not saying that we don't have to be focusing on climate change and other global issues, partly because they're intrinsically important, but partly because that is what much of the world does care about. And we have to take into account the interests and the concerns of the world. But where life gets complicated is when we get to geopolitical issues, which are not only still with us, but I would say increasingly with us, particularly the rising strength of China, the new reassertiveness of Russia. Robert's obviously going to talk and has talked about this before, and as well as India and Japan and other great powers that are involved. And here, when we talk about collaboration and mutual dependence, life gets a lot more complicated. In Western Europe, concerns about a rising China and a rising or a reassertive Russia take a completely different aspect than they may even in a conversation that we might have. There just isn't that sense. Either there isn't a sense of concern or there is a desire to sort of avoid the issue as much as possible. So when Americans press on those matters in Western Europe, they push back. In Eastern Europe, of course, there's a different attitude. There's more concern. So when it comes to developing collaborations, we're dealing with a more fragmented, because the threats are more fragmented, we're dealing with a more fragmented group of nations. I assume in Asia there is enough concern about a rising China, although if you look at Australia's foreign policy these days, maybe there isn't as much unanimity on that, but I think you'll find America's ability to reestablish its relations with other powers to be greater in Asia, more complicated in Europe. Afghanistan, I think the good news is that Europe is in with us in Afghanistan as well as Australia and other countries for the long haul. The enthusiasm for this in Europe is a number approaching negative one. But the commitment to it, nevertheless, paradoxically, seems to be fairly firm. But I don't know the way out of Afghanistan. But the challenge to us is going to be creating perceptions and realities of common interests when we no longer have the single unifying threat of the Soviet Union or communism. And I think that is going to be, it'll be easier on issues like climate change. It's going to be harder on geopolitical questions.
Thanks, Bob. To you, Bob, if you look over the last 10 years, the biggest change in terms of global politics is the rise of China and India. Say a little bit about how you think the interaction not only with the United States, with these two great powers, but also between them is going to influence politics.
All right. As Bob Kagan said, that while global issues like climate change rise, geopolitics is very much with us and will be with us. The sum total effect of the Iraq war has been to fast forward the arrival of the Asian century. And by the Asian century, I don't just mean economic growth, because that's been with us since the 1970s, since Fortune and Forbes magazine wrote about the expansion of the Pacific Rim. I'm talking militarily in that sense. While we've been occupied in Mesopotamia and European defense budgets have been starved, the militaries of China, South Korea, Japan, India, Thailand, etc., have been growing apace, and not just in sheer numbers, because often you strengthen an army by reducing the numbers and making it more modern and efficient. What's taking shape in Asia are real civil-military post-industrial complexes, powered by cell phones, space satellites, etc. We're not just talking about oxen peasant armies that were symbols of nation-building like right after World War II. India's navy is on its way to being the third largest navy in the world. India may have more warships in the Persian Gulf than we have in the 2030s. Japan's navy, though Japan spends only about 2% or less of its budget on its GDP on the military, Japan's navy has like 4 to 5 times as many warships as the fabled British Royal Navy. 120 warships, in the Pacific, while the British Royal Navy has been gutted, going from 49 down to 44, rather down to 29 warships. What we're seeing is that both the U.S. Marine Corps, the U.S. Naval Services are both in, let me say that the strategic map of the world keeps evolving. Right now, we're focused on Iraq and Afghanistan. But to get beyond Iraq in the years and decades ahead, it's going to be more of a maritime amphibious focus, where there's going to be more of a focus on the Indian Ocean and Western Pacific. And those two bodies of water are going to be organically linked by perhaps a canal built with Chinese and Japanese money across the Isthmus of Thailand, by Dubai Ports World investing in a land bridge across Thailand, and by the Malaysian government building oil pipelines to connect between the Indian Ocean and the Pacific. So it's going to be one basic strategic center. And when we talk about the growth of the Chinese Navy, let me say that for the past 50 or 60 years, the Pacific has been essentially an American lake. That was the result of World War II, the incredible economic destruction in China and Japan because of World War II. That's changing, and it's changing dramatically. And when you look at the growth of the Chinese Navy and the Indian Navy, don't think across the board. Don't think in terms of how many aircraft carriers they have, how much tonnage displacement do they have. Think in terms of their niche capabilities. The Chinese are not like the Russians. They're buying smart. They're not investing in everything. They're investing in submarines, in ballistic missiles, in cyber warfare, in space satellites that can hit, that can hit GPS satellites in space. In other words, and their goal is not to go to war with the United States. It's something far, far more subtle. And this is how the future is going to be much more subtle in terms of geopolitics. The Chinese goal is dissuasion. To dissuade us from coming close to the Asian mainland, to make us think twice because they would have the theoretical ability of hitting an aircraft carrier strike group. The Indian Navy will have an ability to project its power throughout the Indian Ocean. Is China an enemy? No. Will it definitely be one? No. Will India be an ally? Is it an ally? Probably yes. But this doesn't negate the fact that geopolitics is changing in Asia. And while we're completely focused on Iraq and Afghanistan, we're neglecting this maritime aspect. And there are several elements to it. That Bangladesh has a population larger than Russia, 150 million people. And most of them live within a few inches of catastrophe in terms of sea level rise. We could face a disaster. Our Navy and Air Force could face a disaster where you could have tens of millions of Bangladeshis threatened by a superstorm or a super typhoon or something. We've had close calls in the past. In that sense, the Indonesian tsunami is a curtain raiser for the future. And in the future, because of the way that the Australians, the Koreans, the Japanese are building up their navies, the next big catastrophe is not going to be a completely U.S. show. We're going to share the glory and the prestige with other countries in the region who will be able to locate ships over the horizon. One of the reasons, perhaps, that the Burmese government even accepted the visit of the UN Secretary General and made some steps to helping their own people was because of the presence of the USS Essex and with Marines, and it's an amphibious warship right off the coast of Burma. Better the UN Secretary General than a landing of U.S. Marines to help the people. And what we're talking about is that the Indian Ocean and the Western Pacific are becoming the world's strategic highway interstate for energy. Because of the growth of the middle class in India and China, they're going to be consuming vast quantities of oil. And much of that oil is going to come by sea from the Arabian Gulf. And it's going to come across the Indian Ocean, and that's why the Chinese are building deep water ports, financing them, rather, in Chittagong in Bangladesh, in Gwadar in Pakistan, in Sihanoukville in Cambodia. The Chinese are surrounding India in a way. They're spreading south. The Chinese want to be a big Indian Ocean power. Meanwhile, the Indians are expanding eastward and westward to the borders of British India in terms of their strategic focus, and Burma is right in the middle. And that is why Burma has oil, natural gas, timber, hydropower, uranium, minerals, all of this. It's going to be there's going to be a real Chinese-Indian strategic rivalry over Burma. And to close up, what this presents us with is not we're going to have a war with these countries. It presents us with a responsibility and an opportunity. And the responsibility is that Asian countries want us in the theater. Because we're the only great power in the Western Pacific, Indian Ocean theater that has no territorial ambitions because we're from the other side of the world. They want us in the theater in big military numbers to counter, to balance constructively a rising China, a rising India. So the United States is going to have worldwide responsibilities once we get beyond Iraq in that sense. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, we've listened to the first round, and we have furious agreement on many issues. But what's striking, if you listen to reconceptualizing the war on terror, being attentive to great power politics, thinking about a resurgent Russia, rising China, a new India, dealing with some of the issues that Admiral Ruffhead points on in terms of anticipating changes in our own nation, our own forces, what I'm struck by is that if we've learned anything over the last several years is that we are living in an age of limits. And the hardest thing, I think, is going to have to be to make choices. And so what I want to actually push each of you, if you had to make one recommendation, what's the most important thing for the next president to think about in terms of foreign policy, national security, what is it? And Jim, you're first.
Kurt, it's the nature of this. And I think one of the problems is trying to pick one thing has been a problem in our strategy. So I always hate resisting the question, but I resist the question a little bit. But I do think that one place, and we've been talking about it in other places today, that we need to elevate the priority is the intersection between energy and climate, because there are both tremendous risks there for us, both in terms of our dependence on energy and both the environmental and economic and national security consequences of climate change, but also great opportunities. If we can find a way to make these issues work for us, it's an opportunity to build partnerships. For example, we've been talking about the competition with China. One of the biggest questions going forward is whether China is going to pursue a kind of mercantilist approach, a 19th century approach to trying to dominate resources through control and physical presence, or whether they're going to believe in a cooperative market-based approach. If we can then link that to their own concerns about their own environment and their own energy security, in which we move them off the dependence on oil and other things so we don't have to have rivalries over these issues, or the rivalries are less intense, then there are tremendous gains to be reaped. So I guess I would say we can't just pick one. We have to worry about nonproliferation. It's an enormous challenge. When you look at what's happening in Iran, that's got to be very high on a president's agenda. We have to worry about how we combat this very lethal ideology that a small number but very determined terrorists are trying to pursue. But I think that if we can find a more integrated approach that looks for opportunities to collaborate with others, that where we can achieve our own security interests and help theirs, and climate and energy, I think, is a very attractive one in that respect.
Thanks, Jim. Admiral, same question.
For me, I really do believe it's a question of how do you balance out the force, and do you truly see the need to be a globally responsive force that is there ready to support our national interests? Oftentimes, in the case of the tsunami, the Essex mission in Burma, mudslides in the Philippines where the carrier Ronald Reagan has been there for the last week supporting it. Oftentimes I'm congratulated because of how quickly we can respond. And our Navy and our armed forces respond more rapidly than any other armed force on the planet. But the reason we can do that is because we're there. And so the question has to become one of, Do you invest in the military capability that can swing to a kinetic fight or to a supportive, cooperative role, as we've used our military before, in a way that you have that option for global response? And speed is going to be key. And I truly believe that you have to be there in order to influence events. And with that comes a price tag. And those are the decisions that will have to be made.
Thanks. Admiral Bob.
Well, let me inject something in the conversation that we haven't talked about at all, and which I didn't talk about either, although it's my job to do so, which is democracy, morality, and human rights, and things that we used to talk about before they became controversial, or at least somewhat controversial. Because I think that one of the other things that we're already seeing is not only the emergence of great powers, but the emergence of great power autocracies that were all supposed to be gone. They were supposed to be naturally sifted out in the process of globalization. But in Russia, you have the return, really, of an almost czarist political system. And in China, we are not seeing the kind of democratic change that I think most people expected. And the question, I suppose, for all of us is, does any of this matter to us? And sometimes when one hears about the integrative approach and the global interdependence issue, the thing that gets filtered out of that discussion is, does it matter that these other countries are dictatorships and are effectively supporting other dictatorships in Zimbabwe and Burma and elsewhere? I would say very important and very high on the list, if not certainly it must occupy a place with others, is a re-energizing of the democratic community in the international system. This isn't even in the first instance about promoting democracy, although I think that's a good idea, but of pulling our democratic allies closer together, whether it is in something that you would call a concert of democracies or a league of democracies. The good news about this is I think it has a fair amount of bipartisan support. I saw Tony Lake recently speaking favorably about it prominently in the Obama campaign. Senator McCain has talked about a League of Democracies. And the purpose of this really is, again, to bind the United States closer to its democratic allies and also to embed the United States in an international system, but which takes seriously the fact that democracy is certainly what America, I think, most especially has to offer the world and has attracted. If you want to say what is the most attractive thing about America throughout its history, it has been its democracy. And so I think that we should not underestimate both the strategic as well as the moral significance of elevating democracy as a principle in our foreign policy, but also building an international system of allied democracies.
Thank you. We're going to give Bob 1 minute, but get your questions ready. We're going to you quickly. Quick questions again.
All right. A narrow specific thing and a wider thing. The narrow specific thing is he's got to get Iraq right because the progress of the past 18 months has made it the new president's war to lose, perhaps. And if he doesn't jump on top of it, if he doesn't get it right, he's going to be occupied with it for much of his term, and then he's not going to go on to all these other issues that we have, that we've talked about, and that he should get on to. The other thing is he's got to get the force structure right, the new Secretary of Defense, the new president. You know, there's a debate over how large the army should be. Some people say 1 million. Some say that's way too big. The president has to weigh in on that. Are we going to go up to a 300-ship Navy again? Is the Air Force going to get its brand-new tank aerial refueling fleet? Because all these things allow us to be in places around the world. You know, just yesterday, there was probably one of the most successful Daring Do rescue operations the world has seen since Entebbe. That was the rescue of three American contractors who had been held for 5.5 years in the jungles of Colombia with and also a Colombian presidential candidate. We gave the credit to the Colombian military, but behind the scenes, we were involved. We were there on the ground. And that's important. That on any given week we're involved in 60 or 70 countries, deployed, and we in terms of promoting democracy, to do that, if you project your power, your values may follow with it.
Okay, let's take some questions. We're going to take 3 or 4 at a time. I'll keep track of them. Please tell us who you are, and again, a relatively quick question, if at all possible. Thank you.
My name is Malcolm Bund. I just wanted to hear the panel's perspective on Taiwan. When we were in China last year, I got the clear impression that cooperation with the U.S. from China was going to function of where we came out on Taiwan, and nothing you've said to address that.
You don't mind. When it comes to that, I just got back from China and Taiwan, and I had a chance to meet with the leaders on both sides, so I actually might jump in on that one. Let's see if there's any other questions. We didn't answer everything. Not everyone. Anyone else? Over here.
You talk about getting the Iraq war right as a way to get onto other things. It seems like both presidential candidates right now have staked out positions that time has passed a bit. And I'm just trying to kind of wonder whether, in fact, we're going to have a really thoughtful and realistic debate about how to get out of Iraq as part of this upcoming election.
Why don't we start with that, Bob? We'll just go down this way, if that's all right.
I'll leave Taiwan for you.
Well, you can do that if you want.
No, I'll leave it for you. I think in a way we're already starting to have a responsible debate about Iraq because, I don't think it was a responsible position to say that we were going to pull out of Iraq 16 months after the next president is elected, regardless of what's happening on the ground. And my understanding is that that's no longer the position. Maybe Jim can correct me if I'm wrong. I think that the good news is that I agree with Bob Kaplan that I think that we really are in a position where the next president has an opportunity to move things forward in Iraq in a sort of, compared to where it was in 2006, in a remarkably successful fashion. But it does mean a willingness to continue the commitment there. I think what is irresponsible is to say that, is just how do we get out and not focus on, what we leave behind. But I do think that I don't actually quite agree that until we are completely out of Iraq, and I'm not sure you're saying that we can't walk and chew gum at the same time. And I think that we ought to be able to, we should be focusing on Asia. To some extent, we have been focusing on Asia, even though we've been tied down in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I think that we are already at the point of having a fairly responsible debate on this subject, which is far different from the kind of debate we were having, let's say, a year ago, which was, I think, a little bit hysterical. So I think that's probably progress.
Jim?
As I said, I'm not here as a spokesman for the campaign, and the only thing I would take issue with Bob on that is I think the campaign would certainly say that when he says no longer taking that position, I think Senator Obama's position was always that he wanted to end the combat mission and remove combat troops from Iraq, but not necessarily completely leave Iraq. He thinks that there are still a set of interests that we have both in the country and the region. But I don't think this is the point to discuss past campaign positions. I think the important thing on Iraq is to think about what the objectives are and what is an achievable set of objectives. I mean, I think that part of the problem is that, and I agree with Bob, it's become a much better debate in recent weeks, is that this sort of victory and defeat binary choice is just not relevant to what's happening there. The maximalist views of a flourishing pluralist democracy with everything sort of, honey and roses is not going to be achieved anytime in the near future, and it can't be the objective of our military presence. At the same time, we do have long-term security interests in the region, and I think if we define our objectives in Iraq properly, it may be possible to find at least a broader consensus of both across party and ideological lines as to what we can and can't achieve, both with military forces and with diplomacy and economic aid and the like. And it's that multidimensional strategy that focuses as much on the political and the economic as it does on the warfighting side, I think, that ultimately is going to give us the clue of how we get the outcome that Bob is talking about.
If I could respond to the two Bobs, if I could, and it's not really a question of you know, to me, how do we get out? It's a question, as Bob said, of getting it right. And I believe, to agree with Bob, that the I'm very diplomatic up here, what has happened recently is that the conditions are now to work in place to where some of the emotion has perhaps been bled off, and that discussion can go on to get it right. With regard to Taiwan, I have had the opportunity to have some insights into the Western Pacific, and particularly the PLA Navy, for about 14 years. And it's clear to me that when we look in the Western Pacific, and when I look particularly at the PLA Navy, that it's not all about Taiwan anymore. Clearly, Taiwan is an issue, and they will never back off of that. But what I see is a Navy that is restructuring itself, and that the resources of the nation are being applied to that Navy, not only to get to the capability and capacity that Bob talked about, but it's just how they're reorienting it. And they're reorienting it in a way that gets to the sea lines of communication, the sea lines of communication that bring their resources in and their goods and goods out. And they see themselves as a Navy that's becoming a blue water Navy, a Navy that can begin to influence regionally, and then in time will go beyond that. For us in the United States, I think we sometimes lose sight of their perspective. I was in a conversation in the mid-90s with the senior leader of the PLA military, and the discussion evolved around aircraft carriers. And he opined that they would like to have an aircraft carrier in the short term. And when we asked what was the short term, he looked at the ceiling and he said 2050 would be good. So, you know, for us, short term is about 1 o'clock. And so we have to think in those terms, particularly as we deal in the Western Pacific.
Obviously, by Iraq, I didn't mean anything binary where you switch totally from, you know, from Iraq to focus on the other things. It's about getting it right. And I do agree that the national discussion is far more nuanced than it was a year ago. And when I speak and read what Senator Obama's advisors write, they stake out a very responsible, subtle position in many ways. I'd like to jump in on this Taiwan thing. From the Chinese point of view, it's not just Taiwan is regaining the national patrimony. It's Taiwan is an unsinkable aircraft carrier out in the Pacific, at the convex point where China bends, where the coast of China bends. And once China can successfully absorb peacefully Taiwan over the years and over the decades, then just like after we absorb the 48 continental states, we could look outward, they can look outward into a blue water Navy. It's like first get the national patrimony together. Taiwan is not an ethnic issue with the Chinese. I mean, they're Han Chinese, just like the Chinese on the mainland. So it's not like the Tibetans. It's not like the Muslim Uyghur Turks in Western China. It's more of a geopolitical thing that, you know, than we've been led to believe. But obviously, if China absorbed Taiwan gradually over the years and decades, I don't think there's anything we could do about it or would do about it.
If I could just say, the interplay between Iraq and Asia poses some very big challenges for Asia's strategists. And they want us to navigate between two difficult shoals from their perspective. On the one hand, they are a little worried that the United States is a bit preoccupied by Iraq, when Secretary Gates, who really is one of the finest secretaries to serve in many, many years, said that, look, I'm focused on three things, Iraq, Iraq, and Iraq. I mean, the unintended message of that is that the United States doesn't have as much strategic attention focused on other parts of the world. I'm occasionally struck. I coach my daughter's soccer team. She doesn't listen to me very much. She's six. And I tell her friends, look, when you're playing the game, don't all rush to the ball. Hold your positions in the field. And, of course, after about 2 minutes, you've got 12 six-year-old girls clustered around a ball in the middle of the field. And the open green spaces occasionally mimic American engagement elsewhere. Now, I do agree with Bob. I think we've done a better job of late in Asia, but it is a worry. And so if we have to remain at a relatively high level of focus in Iraq, Asians worry that we will be a little preoccupied. But on the other hand, they're very worried about an abrupt departure, an unseemly departure that would mimic in some respects what happened after Vietnam, in which then American staying power and credibility would be called into question. So as Jim suggests, the challenge is sort of getting that right. I would just say, in a world in which you have enormous challenges, which appear to be building everywhere you look, I was struck last week in visits to both Taiwan and China that there really is a responsible, very substantial dialogue that's beginning between Taiwan and China, and I would have not have predicted it. And President Ma, who's really the best that system can produce, has done a remarkable job sort of kind of convening a set of discussions with Chinese friends. And although Asian friends hate to use the metaphor of the ball is in someone's court, the ball really is in China's court now. To make some early determinations about whether they're prepared to have a more peaceful and constructive dialogue with Taiwan. And from our discussions in China, I'm relatively hopeful. I think they appreciate that the world is watching. How they handle Taiwan is for many people in the region kind of a metaphor for larger areas of engagement. And it was striking as we toured the most polluted city in the world today. The Chinese really have a lot of big issues on their plate. It's not clear that they can take another one on right now. We can do one more round of questions. Good. We have a few more intrepid souls. Sir, you were first. We'll go here, but I've got you next, and then ma'am, you're third, or sir third. Go ahead, please.
Would someone take up the question of international organizations?
Great.
Whether NATO, whether UN, EU, where we have more trade than we do with China and India combined, what role are they going to be playing? Hi, Bob.
Hey, Tom.
Okay, so international organizations. I'm going to ask Jim Steinberg to be thinking about that. Sir, you in the back in the blue, the royal blue shirt.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask about Russia. It used to be number one when we talked about international affairs, and we didn't hear a lot about it from you. You know, just for instance, on energy, you know, it's blackmailing parts of Europe now with their energy supplies, climate change. You know, I can see a way forward with China and India and an international regime on climate. With Russia, I don't know what the way forward is with them. Why are they going to participate? Nuclear proliferation, regional stability, Kosovo. There's so many places where Russia seems to be such a big issue. Just reactions, thoughts, be welcome.
Great. We're going to take two more questions this last round. Sir, next in the blue polo shirt over here, striped blue polo shirt. Thank you.
I'd like to ask, my name's Alan Englander, I'd like to ask two questions about Western Europe, one of which the gentleman to my left just asked. Mr. Kagan said that Europeans did not seem to be worried about the aggressiveness of the Russian government, and I wonder how you can say that in the light of control of the substantial control of the Western European energy supply from the Soviet Union. And secondly, I wonder, again, with respect to Western Europe, what the implications are of the growing Muslim population in those countries and the implications of the fact that their population growth is dramatically higher than of the European people themselves.
Thank you, sir. There was one other woman who had her hand up. We'd take one other question. I thought I saw it. No one else? Yeah, we'll take this last question here.
Yeah, just very simply, one word, Iran. What are the strategic challenges? What are our options?
Great. Okay. I'm going to ask each of the panelists to say a few words on Iran, but then sort of divvy up. Jim, if you could do international organizations and Iran, and then Bob, maybe you could talk a little bit about Europe, and then Admiral, I'll let you play cleanup with Bob talking about Russia as well. So, Jim.
Well, if in fact the biggest challenge for us going forward is finding ways to effectively collaborate with others, then how we deal with international organizations and structures of collaboration is really one of the biggest challenges and one of the most important priorities we have going forward. But I think we have to sort of approach this as a period in which we have to do a lot of rethinking about whether the old institutions are well adapted to the current situation and to be very pragmatic about how we move forward. I mean, we've seen a lot of very interesting innovations over the last 15 or 20 years to develop much more pragmatic approaches to these things. So, for example, we have this group called the Financial Action Task Force, which is a grouping of almost all the major countries in the world that have any kind of significant financial system to deal with the problem of money laundering. It's not officially part of the UN. It was created in a very practical way to deal both with terrorist financing and drug trafficking, but it's enormously effective, and it's very pragmatic. It's very non-ideological. We've seen over the last 7 or 8 years the development of a thing called the Proliferation Security Initiative, in which countries have come together to try to work together to prevent the transport of nuclear materials or nuclear weapons. Again, a very pragmatic solution to a very specific but very urgent functional problem. The UN still will play a role. It's important to have a place in which all the countries feel that they have a voice, and we don't want to completely dismiss it. But I think this kind of functional, pragmatic development of tools of cooperation that are designed to deal with specific problems, different configurations, different authorities applying to each. NATO is a very good example of that, in which we've been very pragmatic about thinking about how NATO can be useful to deal with new challenges. And so NATO's role in Afghanistan, for example, is an important example. We now need to think about if NATO's going to do things like that, how does it involve other countries that are not formal members in the decision-making when they participate, whether it's Australia or Japan or others. But I think the sense of being pragmatic about it, recognizing that we need some of the formal institutions that are inclusive from the UN system, but also some of these other innovative approaches, are the ways in which we're going to solve problems ranging from pandemic disease to climate to energy to nuclear trafficking.
Do you want to do anything on Iran?
You know, Iran is clearly one of the biggest challenges that we face. It's important not only because the consequences of Iran acquiring nuclear weapons are unbelievably destabilizing to this critical area that we've talked about so much, the Middle East and the Gulf, but also because of the fatal blow I think it would finally deal to our overall nonproliferation regime. If Iran gets nuclear weapons, many countries are going to follow thereafter. So we have to deal with this effectively. We have to be very clear about how important it is to stop this from happening. I do support the idea of more direct engagement with the United States, not because it will necessarily work, but because there's really, in my judgment, little to be lost. And if we have to resort to more extreme measures, whether they're economic or otherwise, to deal with this problem, I think our ability to get the support of other countries is going to depend on a perception that we've gone the last mile in exploring all the less confrontational approaches.
Bob.
Since I just came from Europe, I must say any European hearing this discussion would be in a state of horror, just because if the strongest endorsement for the UN here is that it should not be completely dismissed as an institution, which I agree with wholeheartedly, by the way, that's a classic American consensus, which is not the way it would be stated in Europe.
And
Jim, if I'm just kidding around, you don't have to clarify your statement. You can clarify for the record. There are reporters in the room, I'm sure. And I mean, you know, I think that certain Europeans would view your discussion of how to deal with these things pragmatically, with which I also wholeheartedly agree, as a kind of coalition of the willing approach, which is, you know, and that is one of the divides between us and Europe is the kind of rigid, or at least in terms of rhetoric, at least the rigid adherence to the UN as the body, as the legitimizing body, which I think most Americans, certainly most policy-making Americans, don't really quite get to. Now, I'm supposed to talk about Europe, and I will. You know, why Europeans are worried about the fact that they're dependent on Russia for their energy supply, and a day doesn't go by in Europe where some official doesn't get up and say, we need to have a comprehensive energy policy so we can stop Russia from picking us off like that, and a day, that same day, doesn't go by without another European country cutting a special deal with Russia, which effectively, you know, undoes somebody else's deal. I mean, Russia is having a wonderful time playing Europe. And I think this is what, if we take Russia seriously as a problem, and I think we should, this raises the very complicated issue, which I think the next president's going to have to deal with. And it's not easy to thread the needle on this. The more Americans say, aren't you worried about Russia, the more Western Europeans say, no. And we sort of, in a way, it's almost like you have to let them ultimately get to the point where it's gotten so bad that they then turn and say, okay, you know, can you help us with this? But I worry that they'll let it get so bad that it'll be irreparable. So it's a real challenge for us to try to steer and help. By the way, our own Russia policy has been incoherent for years, and maybe the next president can have a more coherent policy. And that again gets to, you know, there's a sub theme that in our discussion, which you know, we sound a lot like we're in agreement. I think we are, but there really is going to be this challenge between, on the one hand, pursuing this interdependent approach, which deals with Russia and China as members of this community that we're trying to organize to get things done, while at the same time engaging in effectively a struggle for military superiority, which is what we are doing. We want naval superiority. They don't want us to have it. Russia wants a sphere of influence in Europe. We think that their sphere, that it shouldn't be as big as they think it should be. And I guess the question that we'll have to face is, you know, what winds up defeating what in that situation? You know, is the effort at international cooperation and mutual interdependence going to triumph over these geopolitical schisms, or are the geopolitical schisms going to triumph? And I would say, it pessimistically, that these geopolitical competitions are going to wind up driving the international system more than anything else. If you want to talk about Muslims in Europe, we could talk privately. I mean, I'm not trying to skirt the issue. I don't want to dominate the discussion.
Bob, we're wrapping up quickly, but one or two sentences on Iran.
Well, you know, again, I hate to say, I think Jim is fundamentally right. I mean, what's interesting to me before we go rushing into direct negotiations is there was this kind of hint out of Tehran, I guess it was yesterday, that they're looking at this package. Now, I don't know how seriously to take that hint. But if they are looking at this package under the current framework, which is our position is they have to suspend uranium enrichment in order to get this package, we should not now be saying, yes, we're ready to go talk to them. I mean, surely we should let this phase play out if they seem like there's a chance that they're interested, because that would indicate that the position that the United States and Europe have taken together may be working at this moment. And so while I think that, you know, if this falls apart and we are going to have to deal with serious measures later, it may be necessary to go through the phase you're going in. I'm not sure that this would be the moment to do that.
Admiral.
On Russia, as someone who came into the Navy at the height of the Cold War, the collapse of the operational effectiveness of the Russian military, Russian Navy, was probably one of the most dramatic things that happened. But with the infusion of resources into that Russian military today, the leadership is still in place that remembers what they consider the glory days. And there's a desire to get back to that, although a realistic assessment that it will never be at the height what the Soviet military was. That said, it will be a military that will be able to more effectively play in the regions that the gentleman mentioned in ways that can become more problematic, and therefore it's an area that we have to pay attention to. With regard to Iran, clearly disquieting to not just the Gulf area but into the Levant, and it will continue to be a problem. For me, the irresponsible behavior on the part of the Revolutionary Guard is one that I pay very careful attention to every day, and give great credit to my commanding officers and our sailors who are able to responsibly and very professionally react in an appropriate way so that those situations don't get out of control, but not helpful to the region, and it has to be addressed.
Yeah, international organizations, Russia, Iran. One thing on international organizations, NATO is not dead. So big deal it's a two-tier alliance. It was always a two-tier alliance. During the Cold War, if we had ever had a fight in the Fulda Gap, the Greeks and the Italians wouldn't have been there in heavy forces. We would have been doing 95% of the heavy lifting. The difference between the old NATO, the pre-Cold War NATO, and now is that NATO has a multiplicity of challenges, and we're actually engaged in a war zone, and we're seeing how the United States takes most of the burden. But all NATO countries are involved on the ground in Afghanistan. And while some people may poo-poo NATO, in Eastern Europe, it's a bumper sticker of good product approval to get investments, stabilize politics, etc. They take NATO very seriously. So I think NATO has a really good future. Russia and Iran. Russia is really a neo-czarist regime, and Vladimir Putin, to the extent he's still in power, is the most popular long-serving Russian leader since Tsar Alexander II, who freed the serfs, the Tsar liberator, because Putin has essentially given the middle class back its dignity. He stabilized crime rates and a lot of other things, and therefore he's incredibly dangerous. And one of the games he may be playing is that if we had Russia on our side with Iran, it would be a big deal. It would be a big, big deal. But what is Russia demanding to be on our side in Iran, or implicitly demanding? Give up Georgia. Don't support democracy in Georgia. You know, let Georgia go to the wolves. The same with Azerbaijan and the other states in the Caucasus. And we are not about to do that. So Russia has a lot of strategic choices. It can decide to side with us against Iran, or it can decide not to. It could decide to balance against China or with China against us. And therefore, Russia, because of the popularity of the regime and the strategic choices it faces, is going to be a very dangerous character in international relations.
Thank you, Bob. For a second there, when you said Georgia, I was thinking our Georgia. And I think it's a red state. They can have it. But anyway, can I ask all of you to please thank a wonderful panel?